This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me once again, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, when I turned on the camera to record today, it looked like you were dreaming, and you kept calling out Julian's name. Do you want to explain what that's all about?
Chris, it's probably because I was just entranced. This last week I got tweeted by Nicole DeBoer, and so I've been having her like recollections on the show, playing, you know, Esri and some of the scenes that she played out, you know, at the end of the series. I think that's probably what it was.
Maybe. All right. And yeah, you were channeling her.
Exactly. It was a big moment for me in life. In fact, I'm pretty sure I could die happy now. So
that's what I was thinking after I saw that she had tweeted you. So
yeah, it was a big moment.
Okay, well, that explains it. I feel better about what I saw now.
Exactly. That, Chris, and I just started playing, and maybe it's just this Trek euphoria that I'm having, but they just released for Mac Star Trek Online. And so I started playing that tonight and played through my first mission, became the captain of my own Miranda-class starship. And guess what, Chris? Guess what kind of alien I am?
You gotta be a Trill.
Nope, I'm an Andorian. That's right. There are a lot of fight scenes going on my ship.
That's right.
Awesome.
Your ship must be named the Matt Russ.
It's not named the Matt Russ, but my last name in the game is Matt Russ. I took that as my last name. So a little nod to myself, basically.
You know, I don't know if our listeners who listen only to this show know this or not, because I don't know if we've ever mentioned it on here, but in the Fall book series, James Swallow actually named an Andorian ship after you in the book, the Matt Russ.
That's right. So I thought it would be kind of fun to have that be my last name, and that I would be an Andorian on the game. So yes, I am now the captain of a Miranda class vessel called the USS Narnia. That's right. Okay. I went with my I just kind of threw in a lot of different things there for my geek love, and so. I'm a female Andorian. It's super exciting, and I finished my first mission. I'm on my second mission. This podcast is actually interrupting that, so can we hurry up?
Well, we better get on with it then. And so last month, we started our series on the final chapter, the final 9-episode, 10-hour arc that ends Deep Space Nine. And it's hard to believe we're already back around to this again, Matthew, because it doesn't feel like it's been a month since we recorded that show, but it has. And so tonight, we're going to continue our look at the final chapter with the second episode of the arc, Till Death Do Us Part.
Well, and Chris, I think watching this episode again today, I was struck by really just how this is definitely like a 10-part miniseries, you know, even more so than anything else we'd ever seen in Star Trek. I mean, it really is the last time on Deep Space Nine, and then they give you what happened, because this is an immediate continuation of that. And in fact, you know, the episode even starts picking up with Ezri and Worf on the Breen ship. And so I just think that's really, really cool that they decided basically that the end of this series is going to be this fantastic arc. We're going to wrap it all up, which, you know, really makes me wish they had done the same thing for Voyager and for Enterprise, specifically because they knew Enterprise was ending. It really makes me wish that they had done that with Enterprise.
Yeah, it was kind of odd what they did with the end of Enterprise. Not the final episode, but setting up some totally new story element in Demons and Terra Prime, which are fantastic episodes, but they knew they couldn't go anywhere with it. But here they did what they really had to do with Deep Space Nine, which was to take the time to actually wrap up this story properly. And so here in Till Death Do Us Part, this is one of those episodes, like you said, it picks up right where the last one left off, and then it ends right in the middle of the story again. So you know, okay, I'm going to have to wait till next week and find out what happens next. Now, of course, we get the Ezri and Worf bit at the beginning that you talked about, but then it jumps into a very interesting scene where Kai Wynn apparently is opening a new wedding planning business because she at least is trying to become the wedding planner for Sisko.
Yeah, which I thought was really interesting, the fact that she's made herself available to do the wedding. In fact, she said, you know, I'm pretty sure so-and-so is, we can just get.
And she tells Sisko, like, you probably thought I wouldn't be available, but I'm here for you.
Exactly.
And Sisko's like, oh, joy.
Yeah, you can see Sisko's face is like, play it cool, don't smack her here, don't knock her, you know, down, just play it cool.
But, you know, the thing about that scene is, it is funny when you watch Wynn, and the whole time I'm thinking, like, he does not want you to plan his wedding. But what it does in picking up from the last episode from Penumbra is that, you know, Sisko really has it in his mind that marrying Cassidy is his decision. And that episode ends, Penumbra ends, with the realization that it's not really going to be his decision. The prophets, they have already decided what path he should follow, but he still wants to fight it. And then I think Kai Wynn coming in also reminds him that, forget the prophets, for the Bajoran people themselves, they're not just going to let Sisko and Cassidy get married. This is going to be a huge planetary religious event, whether he likes it or not.
Yeah, and I think it's so funny that he would have thought that in the first place, that he could get away with this. I mean, I feel like he had kind of come to the realization of who he is to the Bajoran people. I guess this is just kind of a holdover, the idea that, you know, being married and getting married is a more private event, you know, especially in the ideas of a human. You know, we tend to think of, you know, when we get married that, you know, we invite the people we want there, and we don't invite the people we don't want there or don't really know, because it's a special event to celebrate something that we want to share with those closest to us. And Sisko hasn't really realized that it would be like, I feel like it would be as if, you know, the Pope decided that, you know, marriage could happen and he got married. Like, the entire Catholic world would want to be there. That's almost what I feel like, you know, would happen.
Right.
And it kind of, the only correlation I can think of to make, you know, for us, what it would be like, you know, and that's exactly what would happen. You know, every Bajoran would want to be at the emissary's marriage.
Mm-hmm. Apart from the actual wedding part itself and the idea of marriage, do you also see it this way? One thing that I see here is that Sisko, he was very reluctant early on to accept the idea that he was a religious figure to the Bajorans. As the series went on, he became more comfortable with it. And then we get into episodes like Rapture, for example, where he really is embracing his role within the Bajoran religion and culture. And it feels that as the series goes along, he does get more and more comfortable with it. But now things are going to get real for him. Like, basically, if you want to paraphrase Sarah, the prophet, to him at the end of Penumbra, she's like, it's about to get real for you, Ben. You know, things are going to get real. And
it's going to get crazy up in this mother.
Okay, that's one way to say it, yeah. And I feel like this may be one final moment for Sisko before the culmination of his journey as the emissary, to where the human side of him and his human instincts are fighting against this one last time, because he points out at one point in this episode that the prophets seem to forget that while he is part of them, he's also a human. He's also a man who has his own dreams and his own desires, and he wants to have his own life. And he says, they say that marrying Cassidy is a mistake. Maybe it is, but it's my mistake to make. So he's still fighting against the prophets a little bit here. But of course, at the end, he fully embraces his role.
Yeah, he fully embraces that role. And I think what's interesting is you really are left with the question, obviously at the end of the series, is this the penance he has to pay, like him being gone and maybe missing his daughter? And then, you know, kind of what happens in the novels is he is gone for a while and he doesn't come back until his daughter's born. It's a big deal. And it takes a very long time for him and Cassidy's relationship to ever get back to normal. And, you know, where they are now, they've kind of basically the prophets have released him. He's done what he needed to do for Bajor, and then they've allowed him to let go. And not be basically of their service anymore.
Right.
Watching him make this decision in this episode was very interesting. The whole idea of sacrificing something for something else and your belief system is a really tough thing to do. And his call is, you know, they're not telling him that he can't, because obviously he can marry Cassidy. They're just saying, we see sorrow if you do marry her. We see, you know, and I don't know. I don't even know what I would do in this situation that he's in. You know, everything he knows about the prophets, and I would be worried that that might mean sorrow for Cassidy and that she would die. Or, you know, for me, that she would die or something bad like that would happen. So I guess he doesn't really necessarily think about that ramification, that might be something that happens. Or maybe he's willing to chance it. I mean, because he ends up saying, look, we're getting married. So and I'm not going to yank you around anymore. I'm not going to keep you stringing along. We're going to do this, you know, so.
While we're talking about the marriage, Cassidy's position here, as I was watching this to prepare for this show, I was really thinking about how I might react if I were in Cassidy's position, because this has really, really put her in a difficult spot. You know, she obviously loves Benjamin and she wants to marry him. And I think that over the course of their relationship, she has wrapped her mind around the idea that the prophets are gods to the Bajorans, and that Sisko is part of them, and there's something special about him in the eyes of the Bajorans, and he's obviously, things have happened to him that have to make you question whether or not this is all true or not, if you don't already believe it's true. Like, it plants seeds of doubt in your mind. But nevertheless, like, I feel like even though she's wrapped her mind around this, and maybe on the surface she's come to terms with it, I still feel like Cassidy doesn't believe that it's true, like in the way that Starfleet and the Federation don't believe that the wormhole is the celestial temple and that the prophets are gods. There's like some other explanation to it. And I think to her, maybe the prophets are just very powerful aliens. But now when Benjamin is willing, and she knows that he loves her too, obviously. And when he's willing to step away from the marriage because of what Sarah told him, it's a huge blow to Cassidy. I don't know how I would react in that situation. What would you do?
Man, I don't know, Chris. I mean, I can correlate this to you know, being somebody of faith, and if I was with somebody and they came to me and said, you know, I feel like God is calling us not to be together. I just don't feel like that's the right thing to do. I can understand that, you know, language. I can understand what they're saying. And, you know, I think that the difference here, you know, for Cassidy, is, and it would be really difficult for her. And she seems to understand the specialness of who Cisco is. I mean, he's been born of a prophet. A prophet had a lot to do with his birth. Basically, he is space Moses / Jesus. You know, they've made sure that he's conceived so that he can do their bidding.
Mm-hmm. And that is how it's written. You know, that's not
exactly
just
exactly.
us throwing
it's not me
in
reading,
some religious
yeah,
element.
Right.
That's
yeah.
That is where they went with it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly what Ira Stephen Bear was putting into the show.
Yeah, right.
On purpose. Mm-hmm. But her understanding of that and then her heart are two different things, I think. And I think that's probably what it comes down to, especially in this mm-hmm. episode.
Right.
I do think, you know, she does seem very willing to accept what happened, you know, that his decision. She's just not going to be happy about it, obviously. But I think she, and I think if they hadn't gotten married and the show had ended without them getting married, it makes me wonder, you know, would Cisco have had, would he have left, you know, I mean, would he have gone or all those kind of things. So there's a whole other way this could have gone potentially if they hadn't gotten married. So I just think it asks a lot of great questions. And again, it really deals, I think, very honestly and openly and authentically with what it means to be somebody of faith and kind of wrestle with these issues. And I really appreciate that again about this show. And I'm glad that they went this way. You know, did Cisco make the right decision? You know, I don't really know. I mean, it ends up playing out well in the novels, but hey, it takes them a very, very long time to recover mm-hmm. from the decision that he made and the length of time that he's gone right. with the prophets. So, you know.
One more thing before we move off this topic. We did a show a while back about the prophets, right? And we were trying to decide whether they see the past, present, and future. And whether they're gods or whether they're just aliens that are able to see events, the flow of time outside of linear time. There's one thing that the prophet Sarah says in this episode that made me think that, well, it was an indication that they're not actually gods. And it is when Sarah tells Cisco, "I cannot change what is to come." So she knows what's to come. She says that you'll know nothing but sorrow. And in Penumbra, she says that I don't remember if she calls it the game or not, but she says things will play out as they should. And here she says, "I cannot change what is to come." And I thought this was a strong sign that the prophets are not gods. They are simply advanced beings that have the ability to see events outside of linear time.
Yeah, I mean, goodness. I mean, it's weird because they obviously can interact and they stop a whole Jem'Hadar fleet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question of whether they can intervene in time, I don't think is a question. I think it's more, I think this might be it. She can't change the future because that's their plan.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. it's not that the prophets are unable to intervene or change the future, but that's the plan. And that plan is not going to change. And in the same way, you know, like somebody might ask, okay, so why doesn't God just change the plan with Jesus? You know, like why not do something different? Well, that's the plan. that's their plan before time, because so they're out of time. So, it's not that they can't. It's just that's what they've come up with, and they're eternal beings. And
they don't want to. That's what they're going to do.
Exactly.
So you're saying that Sarah doesn't have enough votes on the Prophet Council to change the plan.
I don't even know if it's that. I think it really does come down to the idea that because they're eternal beings that do have this ability to be outside of time and kind of see mm-hmm. the timeline, they have come up with this as being the best option.
Well, what you're saying about there being a plan and we're going to stick to the plan plays into another big element in this episode, which is villains unite and Dukat and Wynn coming together. And of course, Dukat is taking the form of a Bajoran now, Anjol, and Kai Wynn is continuing to demonstrate on a daily basis that she has no faith, no interest in the Bajoran religion, even though she's the Bajoran religious leader. And they're both being played by the Paw Wraiths, but of course the Paw Wraiths are the enemies of the prophets. And so how do you see this as being part of the plan as well? If Sisko's the emissary, and for his whole life since he was conceived, he was meant to do what he does at the end of the series, is it the same for Dukat, who oversaw the occupation?
Yeah, I mean, this one I think is interesting. You know, the prophets take somebody who, honestly, just like Moses, he doesn't want to be a part of this. It's not his goal. He doesn't feel worthy. He doesn't right. want to be this person, you mm-hmm. know? So Sisko is just like that. Whereas the Paw Wraiths, they pick some people. They desire power. They want basically to be used to get what they want, which is to be in power. But the Paw Wraiths are just using this desire to get what the Paw Wraiths want, not what Dukat and Wynn want. And yeah, I thought it was really interesting. You know, you watch Wynn, and she's having her vision, and unlike Sisko, who just kind of, he does ask questions in it, like, you know, what is this? Why am I here? His are very quizzical in nature. They're of the scientist. They're of the somebody who is willing to accept, okay, what is this reality? What's going on? She's just all like, tell me what to do right now. You know, like,
right.
She, there's nothing spiritual about her at all. She's just, she's so impatient. She has no desire to experience what she's experiencing. She wants the information so she can get what she wants.
Right. And she doesn't have a plan. She just knows that she wants to be in power, and she's simply looking for anything that might help her achieve that goal.
Right. And I think it's interesting too, you know, she can't even sense that this isn't the prophets, because she doesn't even know the prophets, really.
Yeah, that's interesting. What's really interesting. Where in that opening scene with Sisko, and Sisko's telling her what the prophets told him, and then she's the religious leader of the planet, and she tells him, they never talked to me. I've never talked to the prophets, never met them, but I'm the religious leader. And then, of course, she walks out, and when she walks into Ops, she immediately has a vision, which she thinks is of the prophets, but it's actually the Paw Wraiths.
Yeah, and I think it's really telling that, you know, they give her the exact thing that she wants.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing. I mean, why would the prophets not choose her? Because she wants it so badly, you know, and that's, the prophets never choose them. They only choose people who, you know, are willing to serve. To actually serve, not to be in power. Mm-hmm. That's why they chose Kira in The Reckoning, because Kira's was a willing host. And that's what Wynn has never been. She's always been somebody who wanted power, not to be a servant. And that's very scriptural as well. You know, there's the whole thing in Christianity of if you want to be first, you must be a servant first. You know, you must be last. And so it all comes into it, and you can see it really playing out between Sisko and Wynn, you know, between somebody like Kira and Wynn. There's a huge difference, Wynn and Dukat really are the same type of person. What they want is to be in power, and they're delusional enough to believe, even when she learns it's the Paw Wraiths, she's delusional enough to believe that this is the way to go.
Well, let me ask you this. Now, one thing that in watching the exchanges between Dukat and Wynn that made me, what those made me wonder about was if the Paw Wraiths are using both of them as pawns, or if Dukat is more involved in the Paw Wraiths plan somehow, because we know what happened with Dukat. And when he came into the temple, when he wanted to release the Paw Wraiths, and is what resulted in Jadzia's death. And Dukat seems to know more about the Paw Wraiths' plan than Wynn does. And when Wynn has that vision, which she thinks is the prophets, and the prophets tell her that a guide will come to her, he will have the wisdom of the land. And then, of course, when Dukat comes as Anjol, and he's a farmer, and that's exactly, you know, the light goes on for Wynn. It's like, oh my God, he's a farmer. And they told me he would have the wisdom of the land. Dukat knows he's supposed to be a farmer here. So do you believe that Dukat is collaborating with the Paw Wraiths, or the Paw Wraiths are simply telling him what he needs to know in order to play him the same way they're playing Wynn?
I honestly think the Paw Wraiths are making him feel like he's a collaborator to get him into this, because they know exactly what they need to use to manipulate him. I also think they're doing the same thing with Wynn. They're needing Dukat to have more information so he can, you know, basically seduce Wynn in, you know, and to get her into this. And obviously it's really not that hard. She's completely willing and ready to be taken in by anybody who wants to give her power. And she's so thirsty to be in power and to be, you know, like heard from by the prophets, you know, that it's not that difficult for, you know, and I think, again, this is a hugely biblical thing, for the devil to come as an angel of light. And that's how the prophets come to Wynn. And so it really is something that's so awesome, I think, about this end of Deep Space Nine, is that they are resonating with a story that's been told for thousands of years. And that's why we can kind of really connect with it, because it's this cosmic battle between good and evil in the end. And that in the end, there really is a difference between the two. It makes it such a grand, epic story, and they just bring it down into Star Trek, and it honestly works really well, and that's what makes this really exciting.
It's an interesting twist at the end of DS9, in fact, because as we often talk about here on the show, one thing we love about Deep Space Nine is that it shows us life in shades of gray, and that, you know, whereas TNG is very black and white most of the time, DS9 is very much shades of gray. But here at the end, like you just said, the message is that there is a distinction between good and evil, which is a black and white concept coming at the end of the series that was shades of gray.
Yeah, and I think that What it really does is it shows us how much of life there is that is gray, because there is a lot of gray in life. But in the finality of it, in the thing that has its fullest meaning, life is black and white. There is good, there's evil. There's a lot of gray out there, but there are certain things that are non-negotiable, as in this is evil and this is good. And I think that that's actually a really good representation of life in general. I mean, there's a ton of gray in life, But there are things that are completely non-negotiable in the sense of this is good, this is evil, and the two don't meet. And there's a battle going on in a sense between them. That works really well. And I think it's why Deep Space Nine is resonating so well with fans now that are going back and watching it that may have never seen it before. Because it's mythology. It's and myth instead of just like space stories, you know, what really makes it resonate. And honestly, you know, on Literary Treks, this week we talked to Drew about the Apple and some comics that follow up that story. But I think one of the things that resonates with TOS is that TOS is very much willing to say that there is a good and there's an evil, and we know what that good is, and we're the good, basically, is what they're saying. Right. You know, Deep Space Nine is willing to say, there's good and there's evil, but we don't necessarily always do the good, even though we're the quote unquote good guys. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a little bit more realistic in that sense. We really see that, I think, in the progression of somebody like, say, Sisko, who comes in being somebody who's scientifically minded, very much in the Starfleet mold. And by the end, because somebody who accepts and believes something he would never have before, but sees it to be the truth. And it's just a really great and interesting, and obviously very epic story. The fact that we need a 10-part miniseries to wrap it all up here at the end.
Still on the topic of Wynn and Dukat and talking about her, you know, search for whatever will help her gain power, do you at any point feel like she should either recognize Angel as being Dukat or at least have some suspicions raised that there's something not right about this man? He definitely looks different, but there's something about the way that he speaks. There's something about his demeanor, the aura of him, especially, you know, if she were the religious leader, you would think that she would be more attuned to the Bajoran people. But of course, we know she's pretty much just an ordinary person who managed to worm her way into power. But there are moments where I just feel like the man who oversaw the occupation of your planet is someone who you, as the leader of the planet now, at least from a spiritual aspect, should recognize in aspects of this person beyond just his physical appearance as a Cardassian. Do you think she is just intentionally blinding herself to any possibility that this man isn't who he says he is?
I don't think she's intentionally doing it. I think it just shows how blind she is in general. And, she is somebody who is completely oblivious to just about everything, because all she can see is what she wants and what she doesn't have and how is she going to get it. And, you know, I think that's actually something that could be really telling for anyone. You know, we can all be guilty of that kind of mentality of being just very blind to life and what it is that we want and trying to get it for ourselves. She is completely blinded because she has something in front of her that she wants and she can't see anything else.
Because it seems like Sobor is very suspicious of him from the very beginning. Like, why would this farmer be showing up to see the Kai? And through all the actions of Angel Dukat in this episode, and especially moving beyond this episode, Sobor is suspicious to the point where, of course, he ultimately pays for it with his life when Dukat realizes that he could be exposed. But it's telling to me that he can see it, whereas Wynn cannot.
Well, I think they do that, you know, really on purpose to show you just how much Wynn doesn't care about the supposed religion she's supposed to be the leader of. And they do a fabulous job of, and I think it's subtle the way they do it with Sobor and her, the difference between the two of two people who are very much, on the opposite ends of the spectrum. And in fact, it'll happen a little bit later on when, Wynn finds out who it is that she's been communing with, which is not the prophets, but the Pawwraiths, and the conversation she'll have with Kira. I mean, all of that, it all goes to show that this is somebody who has no real connection spiritually to anything other than what's going to make her powerful.
Right. Well, let's move on to another topic, and continuing the story from Penumbra, we get more with Worf and Ezri on the Breen ship here, and we get more development in their relationship as well as going inside Worf's mind a bit about how he is still feeling about the death of Jadzia and the loss of his wife.
I think one of the most interesting parts about this is that the confusion he gets, as last week we talked about the Trill, and that he really is, I think, placing on Ezri Jadzia. You know, he's superimposing them. Definitely. As if they're the same.
Yeah.
And I think that what this episode does is give them that rude awakening look, they aren't. You know, she really is a different person. But she has parts of Jadzia in her.
But don't you think Ezri is perpetuating that herself when she keeps reminding him that she was his wife?
I think the issue with Ezri is that Ezri is not been trained to be joined,
right?
So she doesn't necessarily know how to deal with what she's experiencing.
But you can see how her actions continue to make Worf feel the way that he does. It's not just Worf's inability to understand who Trill are.
Now I think that Ezri's goal has never been to get back together with Worf. I think it's just to be able to have a civil conversation with the man that she used to be married to.
Yeah, I think so too.
And, you know, when they sleep together in Penumbra, I think it's extenuating circumstances, the stress of the situation they're in, being, you know, stranded on a planet, not sure if you're ever going to make it off, all of those things put together with the fact that she really has not found a way to control all that's going on in her brain from seven different lifetimes. And you put all that together and that's what causes what happens. And I mean, honestly, you can see it in her face when he's talking about, you know, how we'll have many years together. She's like, oh, Nikes. That's not what I had in mind. I thought this was kind of like a one night stand thing. You know, you really do get that picture in on her face. And then, of course, you know, throughout this episode and their torture by the Breen, them coming to the realization that she really is in love with Julie and she just didn't know it, or maybe she did know it and she's just been kind of like suppressing that. And so, I think it's a really interesting story to kind of watch two people have to go through this. And it honestly kind of reminds me of, you know, if you've broken up with somebody and you think about getting back together, the grayness that can happen there. And so it's really not all that different, you know? And so you may have been broken up for like 3 or 4 months and then you kind of revisit, but you realize honestly that you're kind of different people by that point, and it's not going to work out, even if, you know, there may even be some romantic interlude there as well, just as Ezri and Worf have experienced. So it's an interesting story because it's really a story that a lot of people have experienced in life. It's just played out on screen and in a very interesting way with somebody who has a worm in her belly.
Well, and I think this particular episode, in terms of the Worf, Ezri, Julian story that concludes the series, is the... Is this for you the point at which the Ezri Julian story starts to become real? Like, this is where she finally has the realization. She begins letting go of Worf, but she's not in a position yet where she can actually act on the revelation that she's had in the first place.
Yeah, I think this is one of those things. I think the way that Julian approached their relationship when she got onto the station was something that was attractive to her. I mean, they'd already mm-hmm. known each other. She had already been pursued by him when she was Gen Zia. And yet he treated her like she was her own person.
Yeah.
And I think he kind of spent the time to get to know her and who she was and all of that. And he wasn't really, I don't think, seeing her as much through the eyes of, oh, she's Gen Zia. It was more he got to know Ezri. And that's the thing that she really gravitated towards. You know, he knew her as Gen Zia, but he also knows her now as Ezri. And that's what she's really attracted to, I think, is that somebody knows her for her and even the kind of the mess that she is, and that's okay with him.
I think beyond that, from Ezri's point of view, Dax is seeing Julian as he is right now and remembering how he was when Jadzia Dax came out of that airlock the first time and Julian's asking her out to dinner. So Ezri may feel the way that you just said as an individual, as a young woman, but the symbiote as well, that aspect of Ezri Dax is recognizing how much Julian's changed as well.
And yeah, definitely.
Maybe why it's attractive to her.
Well, and I think just that Ezri's characteristics really do play more into being right for somebody like Julian instead of somebody like Worf. And they've already done a good job of that in the show because when they get back to the station, they're going to have that whole conversation and he knows that she knows that she likes Julian. Julian doesn't know yet. But they continue to show the differences between her and Gen Zia when they have the conversation about the Klingon Empire and all of those kind of things. And she's a little bit more pragmatic and those kind of things about all things Klingon, whereas Gen Zia was completely in love with all things Klingon, just like mm-hmm. Curzon was. And it kind of differentiating between the two and how well she, again, fits more with somebody like Julian.
Well, now, how do you think Ezri's going to feel, though, when she gets back to the station and Julian asks her out and they go down to the promenade and he takes her to that new restaurant that just opened up, Algae Paste Emporium?
You know, I think she's going to have a problem with that because apparently algae paste is terrible and it sounds terrible. I can't even imagine, you know, especially since today we're my sister's birthday was this week. And so we went out to a hibachi grill, Japanese hibachi grill, and had the most amazing food. And the thought of like some sort of like nasty paste made up like algae that you would feel like you'd skim off a pond, you know, just sounds disgusting.
It really does. Well, maybe they can get past that. All right. So good development here in the middle of this story for Worf and Ezri and Julian. Let's talk about one more key element of the story. And this is Damar, because Damar, I feel like he really needed to hit rock bottom to become the man that he needs to be as this final chapter goes on, where he can really be the leader of Cardassia, stand up to the Dominion, and help to liberate his people from the grasp of the female changeling and the Dominion. And we saw a start to this in Penumbra, but here, I mean, it really feels like Damar has lost himself. And he's still helping Dukat, which I did ask myself a little bit, why is he helping Dukat in the way that he is? But it's more his conversations with Weyoun that illustrate how he has really lost himself. And then I also found interesting with Ducat that we talk about how Ducat is only interested in his own power, doesn't really care about Cardassia or the Cardassian people. But I did feel like he cares a bit about Damar here in this episode, because he encourages Damar to pick himself up before he completely loses himself. And he says Cardassia needs a leader. But even beyond that, I feel like Ducat was looking at Damar and going like, what happened to this man who used to be my right hand? You need to wake up before you can't recover.
Yeah, I definitely feel like that. In fact, I thought it was oxymoronic that it's Ducat who gives a speech to Damar that's going to help inspire him to mm-hmm. become the revolutionary that he becomes.
Right.
I think that is the kind of spark that ignites what happens a few episodes later as the Breen have joined the Dominion and he becomes sick of himself and who he is. I really do think that those words are ringing in his head from Ducat. And so whether Ducat, you know, meant to or not, I think he sparked something in Damar to create a change. And it's quite interesting because it's exactly the last thing that Ducat, I think he would be doing. Because right. the way that Damar goes about it is probably not the way that Ducat was hoping he would.
Oh, no. I don't think
so
Damar
I think that that's great.
I don't think Ducat was trying to spark in Damar anything that would lead towards revolution against the Dominion.
Oh, but not at all.
But I do feel like he meant it on a personal level to someone who was a friend. And that I found unusual for Ducat, because we get to where we don't see Ducat do things that don't directly benefit him. And by sparking this in Damar, it actually can work against Ducat.
Yeah, and not only does it work against Ducat, but I mean, it has an effect of changing the course of the war mm-hmm. as well. And so it goes to show that one person, no matter how evil, can have an impact for good mm-hmm. by doing something selfless. And I really think this is the last selfless moment you see from Ducat.
Yeah.
I mean, he actually does say something to a man who is in need. He sees it and he encourages him, you know, basically get off your ass and do something. Stop being a drunk, you know, and be the man who you could have been. And I think what's really interesting here too is, you know, Damar says, but no, you could be the leader of Cardassia. And Ducat is like, no, that this is not my path anymore, but it can be yours. And that whole conversation really, I think, does do something in Damar that will play out in the next couple of episodes. And it's just, again, it's kind of like this fantastic writing where I don't think Ducat has any idea what he's just done, and yet it's going to end up playing against him and what he's kind of hoping for.
It's almost like someone who decides to quit a job and they really feel like they're closing that book. They're gonna close that book, burn it. That's it. Final chapter, final word. It's over. For Ducat, it feels kind of like that. Like he's made this decision and he knows what his path is. You just said it's not my path anymore. And I think that's what it is. He's decided that he's going to do the bidding of the Paw Wraiths because he ultimately wants to destroy Sisko and he wants to destroy the Bajorans. And this is his last act, and as a Cardassian. As not just the former leader of Cardassia, but just as a Cardassian, because after this, he really does become something else. Just like Sisko is the emissary of the prophets, he becomes the emissary or one of the emissaries of the Paw Wraiths, you know, he and Wynn together. But it's really more, it's Ducat, because it's Ducat who ultimately has the showdown with Sisko.
Yeah, and I think it's just it's adding an interesting layer that you didn't see coming, I don't think.
Not really, although it does go back to Waltz.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that part goes back to Waltz, but I meant for Damar.
Oh, for Damar. Yeah, you didn't see that coming. No.
Because not only did you not see it coming, but, I mean, he's a character that you really kind of hate that mm-hmm. they're slowly making somebody you empathize with. I mean, the guy killed Zial, which, I mean, I'm a huge Zial fan, and when she died, it was crushing in that mm-hmm. episode to watch that happen. But the way that they are slowly transitioning you to bring you on his side is fantastic. And I think the reason that it is his self-loathing comes from what he did to her.
Mm-hmm.
And because he has that kind of self-hatred for what he did and then becomes who he is, it allows us to be on his side again. Because anybody who feels terrible about what he did like that is somebody who's redeemable.
Right. Well, what are your final thoughts on this installment of the final chapter, Till Death Do Us Part?
I think it's just another great episode. You know, it definitely is getting to that point, even here, where it's in the middle now, and we're really continuing the storyline, and you do need to have seen the last episode, and you're ready for the next episode. I remember, you know, watching this in first run, and honestly being terribly sad that Deep Space Nine was coming to an end, because it was just so fantastic, and it was the first time, I think, that I was really crushed that a show ended. You know, just, and obviously this show ends very well, and there's no complaints really on my part for the end. I was just crushed that it ended, you know. And this episode is just another fantastic piece in the puzzle towards that end. And I love what it's doing. I love watching the show over again and seeing all the little pieces that they kind of plant in this episode that play out later, especially in reference to, say, Damar. You know, it has one of the creepiest things I've ever seen in it, and as well as...
You're talking about Kai Wynn giving Dukat Umax?
Yeah. it's just awkward. You know, nobody needs to see villain love. Especially old villain love. And so, yeah, it's awkward, but this is a fantastic episode and truly, part of one of the greatest ends of any show I've ever seen.
Yeah, it definitely is, Matthew. So next month we'll be continuing our look at the final chapter with the next episode, Strange Bedfellows. We'll be doing regular shows for the next 3 weeks, and then we'll roll back around to that. At that point in time, continue our look. Now, this isn't the only thing we've been talking about related to DS9 and other things in Star Trek this week here on the network. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
A Mock Prime commentary.
He's got his, I love his room chest with the weird lights. And
well, he shops at Spencer's.
Yeah, wherever that is.
Oh, poor Colin.
Oh, that joke will kill in America.
Earl Grey.
Geordi LaForge.
They're, you know, Sherlock and Watson flying in the face of copyright laws that they didn't realize at the time.
The Ready Room.
Emergence.
The entire scene that Picard and Beverly have is about one-upping each other with pointless trivia about the Orient Express that they each have. Well, did you know? Well, Beverly, I knew that, but did you know this? And it's like, what is the point of this scene? I don't...
The Orb.
Trail on Trial.
There are motifs that carry through, like holding her hands behind her back.
Right, exactly. And that's where I think you get the variation on a theme. You know, it's not a new song, it's not even a new verse. It's a reordering of notes to create something different and yet similar.
To the journey!
Costumes on Voyager.
Take that, Enterprise D. That's right. You think your mind was blown in 87. Just wait until you see it in 97. Warp 5.
TOS impressions of seasons 1 and 2.
Once I actually started watching it, I began to understand that it was about our future leading into TOS. It's more of a sequel for us than it is a prequel for TOS.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
The X-Files, Small Potatoes.
When I got to this episode, I got excited.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the ones that I continually find more things to like about it.
Melodic Treks.
The music of a mock time.
Yeah, we can do a Muppets podcast, too. I mean, at this point, we might as well, right?
Right.
I mean, we're doing every other show.
Literary Treks.
The Return of the Serpent.
So they all shoot the dinosaur, and then they look back, and
they
the Klingon...
all have to shoot the dinosaur.
And then the Klingon's like, no, I can't do it. I don't want to shoot him. I can't. If I do it, then I'll turn into one of those Klingons that I don't like. You mean one of the Klingons that's helpful?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in a wide variety of places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download or stream from the website. So go grab some shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. All right, Matthew, since last time we recorded, we received a message from listener Brad Alexander, and Brad sent us quite a lengthy message, so I'm going to paraphrase a little bit here. He said he was driving home from work, and he had a couple of ideas for shows. Let me know what you think. And one idea that he had was related to Babylon 5 and comparing Babylon 5 and Deep Space Nine. Some of the friction that there was between the series, some of the controversies that surrounded the production as well, and the similarities. And he was interested in hearing us compare and contrast those two. Now, I don't think that this would be a topic for the orb itself, because we do want to stay focused on Deep Space Nine nuts and bolts here on this show. But I do think it would be an interesting topic. So what I would say to that is that we may look into trying to talk about that on one of our other shows where it fits better at some point. I do think it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, Chris, honestly, I've never seen Babylon 5. And so I wouldn't know what to say on the subject. I'm sorry. And I'm sure it is very interesting. But for me, Babylon 5 held no interest.
Yeah.
It looked cheesy to me. I think that was the thing.
That was the problem for me as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it could be a fantastic show. I don't want to say anything against something I haven't seen. And I'm sure it would be an interesting topic if the hosts on a podcast knew the, you know, Deep Space Nine and Babylon 5 really well. And we're able to talk about their similarities as well as their differences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same here. I've seen a good bit of it, but I would want to rewatch it before I had any real discussion about it. But it is an interesting topic. The other thing that Brad mentioned here as a show possibility is talking about the work of Ronald D. Moore, because, of course, Ronald D. Moore did work on DS9 as well as on TNG. A little bit on Voyager, and then, of course, he went on to Battlestar Galactica. Brad, what you would want to listen to for this is to go over and listen to another one of our shows called Commentary Trek Stars with Mike and Max, because Mike and Max have actually done a 7-part series about Ronald D. Moore, and they talked about his work on Star Trek, of course. They also talked about Roswell. I'm actually on that show with them to talk about Roswell. They talked about Carnival, Battlestar Galactica, Caprica, Virtuality as well. So if you want a really extensive look at the work of Ronald D. Moore, go over and check out Commentary Trek Stars. And those are episodes 45 through 51. And you can find out all about Ronald D. Moore in depth, get some opinions and some views on that. So, Brad, thanks so much for your message. We really appreciate you writing in. For everyone else, if you'd like to share your thoughts with us as well, you can do that by going to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to us both by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the orb, about DS9, anything you want to discuss about Star Trek, you can do it there. Then in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and you'll find us tweeting away about Star Trek all the time on Twitter under username trekfm. All right, Matthew, when you're not, you know, picking up your copy of Dukat's Guide to Women, trying to figure out how you could seduce Kai Winn, where can people find you?
Oh, you had to go there. Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. Definitely not tweeting out the advice from Dukat Hitchhiker's Guide to Women. secondly, you can find me on Literary Treks with You, talking about the books and comics of Star Trek and that universe, as well as finding me on my own website at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not waffling in between and whatnot of whether to follow the prophets, the paw wraiths, and which one's going to give you a better deal, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. Then on the network, besides doing Literary Treks with you, Matthew, you can also find me on Warp 5 every week, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. And you can find me on my interview show, Matterstream. And you'll also find me every week on The Ready Room, where I'm joined by other hosts from all around the network and special guests as we talk about Star Trek news and all five live-action Star Trek series. And we'll actually be coming back around to DS9 on The Ready Room this weekend. So I tune in for that. Don't know which episode we're going to do yet, but we'll be back on DS9. Before we let you go, we'd also like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, and that is Audible.com. Audible is the best source for audiobooks you'll find online. They have more than 150,000 titles for you to choose from. They have lots of Star Trek books on there, as well as all sorts of other genres for you to choose from. And there are some DS9 books on there as well. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, along with a 30-day trial to see how great Audible is. And if you love podcasts, you're going to love audiobooks. But if you decide at the end of the trial not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep that free audiobook. So go check it out. Go over to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Choose your free audiobook. Your support of Audible helps us keep the Orb coming to you every week, and we really thank Audible for their support as well. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. Another thing you can do to help us keep the Orb coming to you is to make a donation to the network. You can do that by going to trek.fm/donate and choose a contribution level that's right for you. We have original alien illustrations as badges and art prints as a thank you for your donation. Those are done by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. So go check it out. Again, trek.fm/donate. Choose what's right for you, and your support helps us pay for the cost of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the Orb and all of our shows to you every week. And we really thank you for your support of the network.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the Orb.